Welcome, and we convene the February 6th, 2012 meeting of the House Committee on Healthcare. I'm really pleased to see so many of you here. I was starting to think nobody cared about healthcare, but having an audience like this, and I assume a few of you probably have issues that you care about more than others, too. So we're in a full meeting today. We're probably going to have to limit testimony time because we have some really heavy bills up. So be aware of that. If you're thinking of reducing what you're about to say to bullet points, that's a really good idea right now. First off, we are going to move the hearing and work session on 4135 to Wednesday. For those of you who are lined up for that one. I guess that was a popular one. Okay. At this point, we will temporarily open a work session, a public hearing on House Bill 4074 for the purposes of getting testimony from two of our colleagues who are supposed to be someplace else and they aren't. 4074 is now open. Gentlemen, you're on. We will be coming back to this subject later in the hour or 2 hours, but
thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. Real quick, 4074 is a pretty simple concept. It permits insurers, multiple employer welfare arrangements, healthcare service contractors, and self-insured employee health benefit plans to offer health benefit plans that pay cash dividends to enrollees who participate in wellness programs. It permits the employer to pay additional cash dividends to participating employees, as well as the bill defines what wellness programs are. Dr. Jack Lees from the Albany area, as well as Nadine Woods and Cynthia Brooks, will be testifying as well, and they're here today. But they have worked at creating this concept that saves dollars and promotes healthy life choices. They will share a program that they've created that works within their workplace and has been found to be quite effective. John Powell will be testifying as well from his perspective on the bill, because he's helped to give us some direction where it's at today. So I'm going to stop at this point right now, because they'll fill in the gaps for you, and Senator Morris is here also to share.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and colleagues. For the record, Frank Morris. I represent District 8, which includes the Albany-Corvallis area, and the folks to testify on this bill are very good friends of mine. I'll declare that as a potential conflict of interest if it's necessary, but these are really fine people. Having been involved in healthcare transformation discussions for a number of years now, one thing that has occurred to me is that the most fundamental question that any organization, whether it's private or public, should ask when you have a problem, and that is, what is the root cause? And I think what you'll hear today is testimony that takes it back to the level of the patient, as it may be, the employee, as it may be, and how can we create incentives to hopefully change lifestyle choices, behavior, and activities that will have a material impact over the life of that person to reduce healthcare costs. That's a part of our discussion on healthcare transformation that really has not gotten a lot of attention, but I think what you'll see today is evidence of how it is working for Dr. Jack Lees and his clinic organization. And I think you can maybe grasp the vision of what it might be able to do for the broader cross-section of Oregonians to actually change behavior that will improve health and the cost of health. So with that, Mr. Co-Chair and colleagues, we would love to be able to stick around for the balance of the hearing, but we've got other committees to attend to. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
There are a lot of competing interests going on these days for committee time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4074 for now. We will be coming back to that a little later in the committee schedule. At this time, I would like to temporarily open a public hearing on 4122 for the purpose of getting testimony from Representative Greg Smith. And is Anne Marie with you? Oh, right there. Okay. Anne, if you'd like to come up too. We'll be coming back to this issue later in the hour as well.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Very quickly, I wanted to let you know that Representative Bailey, who is the key sponsor on this legislation, is here. Would you like to hear from him first?
You have a conflict too, don't you?
Either way, Mr. Chair, I am at the disposal of anybody.
Disposal?
It would be we'd be more than willing to step back for a few minutes.
Would you like to? Why don't we do that quickly?
Or just bring up an extra chair.
Bring up an extra chair, whatever we have to do.
Oh, we have a loose chair somewhere. That'd be good.
Sorry, I didn't see you come in.
Oh, he's here on another bill.
Yeah. And as per usual with everyone, if you keep your comments short today, because we have a lot of people to hear from, and...
did you announce this?
Please.
Kutcher Thompson, members of the committee, thank you so much for hearing this for the record. My name is Jules Bailey, State Representative, House District 42. I'm going to try to speak a little fast and try to go through what is a fairly complex issue fairly quickly in anticipation of hours of delightful testimony that I am sure you are likely to hear on this bill from both sides. I would imagine that nobody behind me has any interest in this bill. This bill really came from a place, from a couple of different places. It was brought to my attention, and you're probably wondering, what is Representative Bailey doing here with a health care bill? It was really brought to my attention by a constituent, and it was an issue where a friend and a constituent went into a pharmacy and received a letter saying that she was unable to get her prescription covered at her pharmacy and that she was going to have to pay full price for it. Now, it happened to be the middle of the night. It happened to be a prescription that she really needed, and there wasn't any other 24-hour pharmacy available at that time, and so she paid through the nose for it and is still trying to get a reimbursement for that drug now. And that led to the question of, why is this happening? And then I found the wonderful world of pharmacy benefit management companies. And as we've dug into this with experts and as we've done our homework on this, what we've really come to understand is that you have an entity in a pharmacy benefit management company that is living at the center of this relationship between a payer and a retail pharmacy outlet, whether that's an independent pharmacy or a chain, that really has enormous market power. And it's that market power and those contracts that are really at issue here. And so what this bill tries to do, first and foremost, is to provide transparency. I think PBMs, you'll hear, will argue that they lower costs, ultimately, for people not only that are getting their health insurance, but also for people that are picking up their prescriptions. That may be true. It may not be true. I think the principle here is show your work. And what we're looking to do is make sure that as PBMs negotiate these contracts with pharmacies and as the state, for example, or other insurance providers negotiate contracts with PBMs, that they're able to see down through that contractual line and understand where the puts and takes are in terms of the revenue stream. Because otherwise, you have what is essentially a large entity at the center of this relationship that can, through profit maximization, which is a great principle of the free market, though drive up costs through inefficient negotiation. And that's one of the things I wanted to focus on. As an economist, one of the things that we look at is how do we create well-functioning free market economies. And free market economies are predicated on the theory of perfect information, of the idea that we can understand our costs and where they're coming from, and that we can negotiate appropriately within those cost structures. And that's what really delivers savings to consumers and savings to businesses. And so the hope here is that this bill actually reduces costs to taxpayers, taxpayers by allowing the state to better negotiate with pharmacy benefit management companies and provide some transparency around how drug companies and rebates play into the cost structure of a PBM. Finally, this bill is really about access and about safety. And the fact is that if we are forcing local retail pharmacists out of business through unfair negotiating practices, then that really puts our communities in jeopardy for a number of reasons. One, your local pharmacist is often your best point of contact for being able to understand your prescriptions and their drug interactions. Two, that if you imagine you are sending your 8-year-old home from the emergency room at 3 a.m. and you've got to pick up a prescription on the way home. Well, if your local pharmacist isn't available there, then that's a problem, clearly. For rural communities especially, when you have only one or maybe just a couple of pharmacy providers, then you have a real market issue there if they get into a contract dispute with these very large and powerful pharmacy benefit management companies. So there really is a state and public interest in ensuring access and ensuring transparency to protect consumers and to protect taxpayers, and that's what this bill is about. So we have support from a number of different groups on this bill. We've received support from doctors, from pharmacists, from people who really care about patients and ensuring access. We've had support from those who are looking at driving down costs to the taxpayer and to the state system. It is a complicated bill, but the principles here are simple. And if you'll permit one more comment, I want to just comment that you might hear from some of the other folks that are testifying that they're that Maine passed a law on pharmacy benefit management companies that caused them to then pull out of the state. And you'll have before you a fact sheet on why this law is very, very different. This is not additional regulation. This is not an increased burden. What this is transparency and making sure that we're able to see the kinds of things that will hopefully lead to cost savings. And with that, happy to turn it over. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Excuse me for a second. I wanted to clarify that. So you're saying this is a very different bill from Maine?
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Vice Chair Kennemer, that is correct, and we're happy to provide you with a fact sheet on that. This is a completely different animal than the bill that Maine passed, other than the fact that it has to do with PBMs.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Bailey before we excuse him?
I did.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you to my colleague for his deference.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Appreciate this opportunity to introduce myself. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing Union and Wallowa and Morrow and parts of Umatilla County. Thank you for letting me come here and just share a few thoughts with you. And let me share with those members who may not know this, Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson have been out to Morrow County, and they've been up to their elbows in pharmacy management issues. I just want to take a brief moment and share with you that I support passage of House Bill 4122 and share with you why. I have a son who, 9 years ago, was diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic. Insulin dependent, and as you can imagine, with that dependency comes tremendous medical need. Couple that with the fact that but for our local rural pharmacy, I live 55 miles away from the next closest pharmacy. And so when you have times of need, time of emergency, it's paramount that you be able to work with those closest to your situation, those who know your children, those who know the medical conditions you're dealing with. Obviously, I would care to share with you that I don't believe a PBM can provide that level of care, and that by passage of House Bill 4122, we're going to bring transparency forward on a healthcare system that perhaps needs that transparency. And at the same time, most importantly, it's going to provide the healthcare that our rural children need. And so I don't want to take a lot of your time today. We've got two experts here. The Murrays, they're my neighbors. They live right down the road from me. They're entrepreneurs in the community of Heppner, and they're very, very good citizens. And Mr. Co-Chair, I hope you'll take a moment and hear the testimony they have to offer. Thank you.
I have been to your district, Representative. Your neighbor might be 35 miles away.
So that is correct, Representative.
Different world.
Yeah. And I want you to know, Mr. Co-Chair, Morrow County still appreciates the effort you exhibited by coming out to our neck of the woods.
We go anywhere, anytime.
Thank you.
Ms. Murray.
My name is Ann Murray, and I'm a pharmacist in from Heppner, Oregon. I'm here with my daughter, Lori Murray, a pharmacy student and intern. Our family owns Murray's Drug Incorporated with stores in Heppner, Condon, and Prairie City. It's a family business serving Eastern Oregon since 1959 with three generations of pharmacists, five licensed, one intern, and one applying to pharmacy school. We serve Morrow, Gillam, and Wheeler counties as the only pharmacy in those counties and the eastern half of Grant County. This equates to over 5,000 square miles of rural eastern Oregon, involving a population of about 15,000. Just over a week ago, I spoke to an Associated Press reporter who's doing a story on why so many independent pharmacies have closed across the nation, and Oregon in particular. On February 1st, Boardman Pharmacy closed, leaving us as the sole Morrow County pharmacy. I will tell you now what I told him. The reason that access to pharmacies are decreasing, especially in rural areas, but will continue into the urban ones, and why healthcare costs continue to skyrocket can be summed up into three large, should I say capital, and very powerful letters, PBMs. I urge you to read an article that I can provide, written in 2002, 10 years ago, by Ed Heckman, called Evolution of a Hurricane, explaining and predicting what would happen if PBMs became more powerful. He warned that PBMs would greatly increase the cost of health care by adding the expensive middleman layer of bureaucracy instead of insurers being able to directly contract with pharmacies that are actually doing the work of the health care. Nationally, as we speak, two of the three giant PBMs, Express Scripts and Medco, are attempting to merge under FTC scrutiny, creating an even greater monopoly. According to Forbes.com, the four highest paid CEOs in 2011, Express Scripts ranked number four, bringing in $51.5 million. Pharmacies and doctor's offices alike have had to add staff and expense to deal with PBMs on a daily basis, as they put increasingly number of drugs on their prior authorization required status or reject claims for many reasons. If you may have personally tried to fill a prescription that's been blocked for coverage by the PBM or else not on the formulary, how certain drugs get on the formulary is a whole issue in itself and a reason that transparency regarding rebates should be mandatory. Insurers need to know, should know, where the money is going. I would estimate I have to call PBMs at least twice an hour, with calls lasting 5 to 20 minutes to resolve claim issues as we try to help patients fill their prescriptions. The main reason that PBMs are driving pharmacy out of business is the take-it-or-leave-it contracts that they offer below-cost reimbursement. Last Thursday, I worked in our Condon store. We drive an hour each way to staff that pharmacy. I dealt with a prescription for an elderly patient in the assisted living facility. The PBM was paying $27 below my cost. It cost me $224. They reimbursed me $197. I called the help desk that we are instructed to call. They told me that they only help with claim adjudication issues, and for reimbursement issues, I would have to call the plan. I called the plan. The plan directed me back to the PBM. They couldn't help me. I asked if they had a provider relations department, and I waited a long time. I was finally given a number and had to leave a message. It's my experience that you never can talk to a person in the contracting department of PBMs. So I left a message. I asked them what I should tell the patient who was rapidly running out of medication. They didn't have an answer. National dispensing studies have shown it costs about $10 per prescription in overhead to dispense that prescription. This would have put my loss at $35 on that prescription. We do between $70 and $100 in Condon. We sell mostly prescriptions and don't have a lot of other merchandise to cost shift to. We buy from a national wholesaler. But PBMs don't understand that smaller stores don't necessarily, well, they don't get the same price as the larger volume stores. And PBMs are not responding to the changes in the cost of a drug with market supply and demand supply problems. We've had huge supply problems. You've probably heard nationally, certain drugs you just can't get. Cost goes up, but the PBMs are paying you at last year's price. That's been a big problem. PBMs are constantly faxing us new contracts that keep dropping the reimbursement with, quote, you will no longer be in our network if you don't sign by such and such a date. We've had to refuse many of these contracts, leaving patients to drive long distances or wait for the drugs in the mail from the PBM-owned pharmacies. The help desk at the PBMs will say, the patient can drive to the nearest participating pharmacy, or it can be mailed to them from our mail order pharmacy. Do they care, or could they even believe, calling from New Jersey, that many of our rural customers get mail 3 days a week delivered? We know that signing these contracts is a slow death, as is evidenced by so many small stores closing. Even if you can determine what your payment will be before signing up on one of their contracts, their ability to change the MAC, the maximum allowable cost, which is how they price generics, a per tablet cost, they change it. They can change it at any time. Now, this defies the traditional understanding of what a business contract is or should be. If one party can change the rate agreed upon at any time, how is that a fair contract? Lack of access to pharmacy services is a direct result of PBMs directing business away from where customers want to buy their medication. In rural Eastern Oregon, this is showcased as a reduction in care as elderly or sick patients are unable to drive the 2 to 3 hour, at the minimum, round trip to Hermiston, Pendleton, the Dalles, or south to Central Oregon. We have a large population that gets confused when we say, sorry, your PBM says you have to get it from their mail order. They say, and why is it one price for a 90-day from the mail order and the same price for you, but I can only get 30 days? I say it isn't fair. I don't know how antitrust or anti-monopoly legislation doesn't apply to PBMs in this country. Many of our customers appreciate our presence, and we're proud to be there. We have about 20 people on our payroll between full and part-time, which may not seem like a lot, but in our economy, in our towns, it's important. To make our payroll, pay our state taxes, we cannot operate in the red. A long time ago, a certain number, only a small percentage, had co-pays and used PBMs. However, today, Part D, everybody, almost 100% of our scripts go through a PBM. This leaves us at their mercy and their ability to dictate contracts and force customers away from us to out-of-state-owned PBM mail-order pharmacies. I urge you to support House Bill 4122, provide transparency for insurers, access and freedom of choice for patients in Oregon, and a fair and competitive healthcare marketplace. Other states have already enacted transparency legislation. Oregon aspires to be on the cutting edge of healthcare reform. This legislation would be an important and a worthwhile step towards that goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? We're going to have more testimony. I'm going to close this public hearing. We'll go on to other things and come back to it. But if there's questions for these particular people, this is not the end of the hearing.
Mr. Chairman White, we're going to close the public hearing and then we're going to come back to it?
And we'll reopen the public hearing, yes.
Okay.
We've got a couple of legislators who need to be someplace else. Scheduling problem. So
I'm going to let the students speak.
Okay.
Did you want that?
Any further questions? Thank you very much. I am hereby closing the public hearing on 4122 for the moment, and we will be coming back to that. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 4046. Give us a breakdown on where we are on that bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4046 is the bill that exempts certain accident-only specified disease and hospital indemnity insurance policies from payment of the assessment on the gross amount of premiums. It is effective July 1, 2013. You should have a dash one amendment. The amendment changes the current date of the expiration of the assessment is September 30th, 2013. The amendment changes it to July 1, 2013. We do have a fiscal and a revenue impact on both of those, on the amendment. And we have folks from Friday. This was a carryover bill.
Are we ready to move on this bill then? Do you have everything you
need? Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, we need it for a public hearing, right? A work session. You could work it today.
Yes.
If Representative Greenick is back.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. I'd like to call Scott Berry and Inga Deckert, please. Inga may not be here.
Yeah, I don't
see her. She was here Friday. She's disappeared. Guess it's you, Scott.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Berry. This afternoon, representing Aflac. Here in support of House Bill 4046. Our understanding is that the original intent of House Bill 2009 and its funding mechanism 2016 was to provide access to health care for uninsured children in Oregon. To fund the legislation, there was a 1% tax placed on health insurance premiums defined through the bill through the entire session as health benefit plan. There is and was a nexus there as the potential benefit gained from health insurers for health insurers, as more children obtained health insurance and fewer of them used the emergency room health plan. And that many of the parents used that emergency room health plan to treat their sick or injured kids. My understanding is that much of the cost of the emergency room health plan is eventually borne by the health insurance companies through the cost shift. So again, there's a nexus there between traditional health care and the 1% tax. In addition, I believe that the traditional health insurance companies were able to pass that 1% tax on as they placed it inside their premiums. As the 2009 session drew to a close, the definition of which policies would be taxed was changed. And those final days and hours, the definition change brought in some supplemental policies. As we look at the supplemental policies, they're not currently excluded from the list. It's easy to see there's no nexus between those policies and the Healthy Kids program. The policies are never increased once they're set. They can only be canceled by the policy holder and not by the supplemental policy provider. They are paid directly to the consumer to make up for lost wages, but can be used for child care, a house payment, or anything that the policy holder determines is worthy. We're a little like workers' comp for the house. I fall off my roof, I break my wrist, and as long as I'm not able to go to work, I receive a check monthly from the provider until I can get back to work. Again, that check can be used for anything the policyholder desires. It does not go to a doctor or other health care provider. And finally, unlike traditional health insurance, there's no connection between the supplemental policies included in 4046 and the downstream benefit to be gained. No cost shift whatsoever. We're outside of that process. We weren't in the room to explain this in the final days of 2009 as this bill moved, as the 2009 and 2016 moved forward, and probably did not belong in the room because we're not health insurance. AFLAC and the supplemental policy providers have paid the tax up until this point, and under this bill will continue to pay that tax until the process is finished. And to that end, actually, I'd like to introduce and just briefly talk about the Dash 1s. The original bill had the date that these policies would be pulled out of the premium tax as July 1, 2013. We've moved that back to September 29th, 2013 with this amendment, and that's right before the actual original bill sunsets. Our interest with this is basically this body making a clear statement that these supplemental policies not be included going forward. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the panel? Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Two-part. So can you tell us how much your company's paid to date? Because I also don't think that your health insurance, I know people who sell this, and I'm not getting to take you to the emergency room if I have a policy with you. How much have you paid? And I want to understand that you're not asking for, like, some kind of check back from the state for what you've already put in.
Co-Chair Thompson and Representative Parrish, correct. The bill, to answer your last question first, the bill would not retroactively ask for any of the previously paid taxes back at all. It simply removes those three policies from the tax moving forward, which may not be very long, but depending on other discussions and what happens with the premium tax, our interest is in just being removed before that point. And then to answer your first question, I believe it's somewhere under just under $1 million in tax thus far.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Campbell, please.
Earlier, there had been an issue with the fiscal impact. Have you seen the amended, and are you in agreement with it?
I don't think
Co-Chair Thompson and Chair Kennedy, my understanding is that the co-chair with the Dash 1 amendment is referred to as minimal.
Yes.
And it's, I know it's, you know, according to our calculations, maybe a few hundred dollars.
Yeah.
But, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
The revenue does still show that there's about a $1,600 revenue impact, and with that, we will need to get clarification as to, if it's the expectation of the co-speakers to go to revenue or if it could go directly to the floor with the revenue.
Okay. Any other questions on this bill? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 4046. We will not be working the bill today, although we have apparently have all the paperwork, until we can clarify the routing for the revenue piece. It doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem. It's just we have to do the right thing at the right time.
Okay, thank you.
So I think you've done your work.
Thank
you. Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4046. And we will put that to February 8th, which is Wednesday, for the next action. think you're going to find in this short session, we have stuff coming at us like machine guns right now. So there's going to be a lot of this kind of stuff happening where the paperwork or decisions aren't catching up with the speed that the bills are moving. So anticipate there are going to be a lot of issues where bills are going to snag temporarily. You know, don't go crazy over it. It's just procedural because we have staffing problems on top of everything else.
Yes, we do.
Okay. I will now open the public hearing on House Bill 4127. And Madam Assistant, would you tell us what that's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 4127 requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt standards and procedures to certify specified mental health providers to qualify for insurance reimbursement. It declares an emergency effective on passage. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This is also a carryover from Friday. Did you want?
Sure.
Welcome.
Hello, fellow committee members.
How are you?
My name is, for the record, Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14, West Eugene, and Junction City. So the history of this issue is that it's a very straightforward bill, and it was brought forth to close a loophole inadvertently created by the 2005 legislature. The Mental Health Parity Act of 2005 repealed the statute that gave addictions and mental health the authority to establish standards and approve non-inpatient mental health providers for the purpose of insurance reimbursement, and that had been in place since 1989. Non-inpatient mental health providers are mental health agencies that do not provide public mental health services through contract with the county or state. The Mental Health Parity Act went into effect in 2007, but without realizing that the authorizing statute had been repealed, AMH continued to certify these providers for insurance reimbursement. Last year, so this was standard practice. Last year, the Attorney General's office released an opinion saying AMH no longer had the certification authority and that these mental health care providers were issued a letter stating they were no longer able to receive reimbursement effective immediately. The providers, you know, universe for this group are as follows. There's approximately 50 clinics and five in rural counties. While many of these providers within these agencies hold a license from a mental health board, there are also a number of other long-serving, highly skilled clinicians who do not hold licenses but have a level of experience that allow them to really be the best person to treat and give services to a population that really, one, we don't have a lot of access for, and they do provide treatment. Again, this was standard practice. We believe it was an oversight that the initial practice was changed, and this bill will simply reinstate the authority for AMH to certify the non-inpatient mental health providers for the purpose of insurance reimbursement. And then we added a -1 amendment, and those amendments clarify that fees will be collected for the certification process and used only for the purpose of carrying out the provisions of this bill, and it is a self-funded program.
Any questions for the representative? Must have done an excellent job.
Excellent.
And rapid.
And we'll call John Powell now. Oh, there you are, John. Couldn't spot you there.
Yes, she did. Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chair and members, this bill was before you in the 2011 legislative session. And we offered to meet with the proponents. That has not taken place yet. They did call us during the interim. I have to confess, my definition of interim is different than it's playing out during this interim. I thought the interim was the 18-month period between the full sessions. We were told numerous times any contentious things would not
move. This committee taught me a lesson in that Friday.
We're all learning, believe
so,
me.
Given that, Mr. Chair and members, we would ask that this bill be held over for that session so we can sit down with the proponents of this bill and really find out what the problem is. Regents will contract with individual providers within these clinics. This is a carte blanche. You get everybody in the clinic. And as Representative Hoyle pointed out to you, some of them are not licensed providers. We need to know who they are and what their function. We credential providers, which means we assure our members of a certain competency level, and to a certain degree, we depend upon their professional licensure and its ability to be removed as part of that credentialing process. So we would be glad to sit down with the proponents of this legislation, meet with them, and try to narrow, if we can, the issues before us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions?
Just a comment, and to be fair, I think we all are learning the new. It's a whole new different type of session. So this was a bill that came up during the last session, and it died for reasons that were not related to this particular bill. There were votes to have it come out of committee, but it just ended up being one of those things where time ran out and things happened. But this was and is current practice, and the people that are being that are certified by the state either have the experience or the licensure to provide the services. So to be fair, it's not like we're saying let's give carte blanche and do something different than we are already doing. And it was a bill that was presented last session that Representative Buckley had and did a fair amount of work. So again, I always appreciate working with you, and I appreciate your concerns. But I think that this is different than something that just came up in this particular session. It's been there for a while, and DHS and it was both the providers and addictions and mental health came up and said, "This is." Is there something that we can do about this to fix a problem that we don't think it was intended?
This one,
please.
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlich, and Representative Hoyle. The issue is not so much those who have been authorized by the state in the past. When an insurer credentials someone and a clinic changes new providers and that sort of thing, that will change over time. And we would like time to sit with the proponents of this to see how we handle situations like that if we believe there is a quality issue with a certain provider and that sort of thing. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4127. We will open the hearing on
Mr. Chair, I apologize for being late. I was next door testifying on a conflict of interest.
Okay, half of that committee was here testifying.
I know. We were.
Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 4164.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4164 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Greenlich has moved House Bill 4164 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
We read back the. Is there a fiscal or anything on this?
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, on the original bill, no, there is not. There's no fiscal, there's no revenue impact.
carry this bill? We co-carry?
I sense a question coming on.
Well, I'm not quite sure if it's a question because I'm trying to find it. Did I read that the section on this bill where the Oregon Health Exchange employees were going to be part of, like, kind of experiment? Is that out of the bill now?
We thought we'd just leave it in and
see
what happens on the Senate side.
It allows them to explore the possibility of how that might work.
Exactly. Okay, thank you.
That was the Dash 1 amendment.
That's right.
And we're not moving the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're not moving the Dash 1.
Thank you for the clarification. Anyone else?
Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
I was a no on SB 99 coming out of the committee last time and no on the House floor. I don't have a good sense that the state of Oregon can manage big projects. I mean, we've seen that with the state radios. We've seen it with, you know, bridge that we spent $200 million or whatever that is so far, and we haven't bought a box of nails. We've seen that with other big projects, and I think that there is some concern that that we can't manage these big behemoth projects. I consider this one of those big projects. I was encouraged, today, talking to the governor, that if this goes south at some point, if we don't get the numbers into the exchange that we think we need to get into the exchange, that, that there would be a willingness to look at how do we pull the plug and go back to voters and say, hey, we tried something, it didn't work, and there's no need to keep something moving forward that isn't working, because we've done that. We still have things, programs out there right now that, don't really serve a purpose, and we do them anyway because we've built constituency groups around them. We have employees that are employed by those things, so we just kind of keep the light switches flipped on. So the fact that there's some notion that if this doesn't work, that we can come back and revisit it and say, turn the shutoff valve off, then I'm going to go ahead and give it the tentative support to move it today out of committee. With that in mind, and me on the record is saying that if in a few years this isn't working and we don't make the numbers that need to be made and this isn't saving costs like we think it's going to do, then we come back and we revisit it and we shut the thing down if it need be.
Amen, sister.
Mr. Co-Chair, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that this program is operating currently off of federal grant funds. Not that that's not my money, too.
That's right.
But
it's my money, too.
It is. It's helping to bring some of the taxes we send to Washington back to Oregon.
And it's also my understanding, if in the future, if we don't get enrollees into the program, we don't get insurance policies into the program, or it isn't self-supporting, it has to come back to the legislature to continue payroll. Is that...
Currently, there is no other way to support it except the federal funds in the fee.
There is no commitment
beyond those.
I think the safety is built in, and it would require the legislature to act in a very heavily financially loaded model to continue this beyond the federal funding.
Well, and I would say, in terms of support of it, the financial estimates for the sustainability of it are really very, I mean, it's a very low estimate of members. As I remember, there was a high estimate, a medium estimate, and a low estimate, and the amount required for sustainability was half of the low estimate. So, I mean, it's pretty, I think their assumptions are pretty safe. But I must say I concur with my colleague that it's not making it the last thing we want.
In this political environment, I wish you hadn't mentioned assumptions, because that's a pretty big departure.
Yeah.
Representative Daugherty.
And Representative Thompson, I was just going to reiterate what you said, that there are already some safeguards built in there. But also, I mean, if we do anything this session for small businesses, this is one of them. This is one of the biggies.
Yes.
And we don't have the resources to do what we want to do for a lot of our businesses and our workers here, but this is the one thing that can go forward. And I'm just hoping that, keep my fingers crossed, that it does work. It's going to be a big one.
Mr. Chair, it's also my feeling. This is, I think of all the bills that I've passed, there's maybe one accession where all 90 members can take home and be proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one that basically we can all say we've actually done something for small business and individuals.
Any further comment? Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to add to Representative Daugherty's comment and say that for families and individuals that want to be access health insurance, I think this is important, too. I realize I came late to the game, and there's been a lot of really hard work that all of you have done on this, and I'm really excited to be at the table to be able to support it.
I think we all share that sense that this could be a really great program and it could be really helpful for a whole lot of people, but like everything else we embark on, the devil's in the details, we'll have to wait and see. But I'm optimistic that this has been designed well to this point, with full knowledge that we don't even have all the federal regulations under which it will operate coming down on us yet. So there's more building to be done. Nothing's going to happen next Tuesday, and we'll have some time. If there is nothing else, I would ask our assistant to call the roll.
Representative Conger?
Do we have a motion?
Aye. Oops. Do we have a motion?
We have a motion?
Yes.
Representative,
did I jump the gun?
We were talking. We're sorry.
I've got a maybe for him. Excuse me.
Do you want to start over, Mr. Chair? Again? I'm sorry.
No.
Call the roll.
Okay, there was a motion. We began the work session with a motion I put on the floor. So,
Do pass with amendments? No. Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Perry?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenemer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye.
And, how about if you and I co-carry it?
I'd like that.
Okay. Done.
I'd also like to comment, Mr. Chair, about the work that the staff of the exchange have done, getting it to this point, working with the Legislative Oversight Committee, working with all the constituents. I mean, they've done an extraordinary job to get it to where it is. And while Mr. King, for reasons of illness or accident or something, wasn't able to be with us today, I hope Amy takes back that our commendation to him.
You'll notice when either Co-Chair Thompson or I are in the chair, we move our mouth, but the words come from our administrator. She's now reloading the co-chair with the words for it.
Okay. I apologize for the delay. We're jumping all over the page. We have to know if we have paperwork ready bill by bill. And it's getting a little like a traffic control tower here with all the windows blacked out. Okay. At this point, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4074. Would you give us the details, please?
Well, Mr. Chair, you just opened that up for Representative Olson and Senator Morris to speak to. This is the one that permits the insurers and the multiple employers, the welfare arrangement, health care service contractors, and self-insured employee health benefit plans to offer plans that pay cash dividends. And here's your sign-up sheet, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We have John Lees and Nadine Wood and Cynthia Brooks, please. And you may start as soon as you're ready. Please identify yourselves for the record before you speak. And again, I'd appreciate keeping it brief because we have a lot to do yet today.
Okay, do you have those pamphlets that's sending out?
I think he's got them.
Pass those around,
yes.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlee and Representative Thompson, and committee members, I'm John Lees. I'm a physician in Albany, Oregon. I'm not going to go through my testimony. I'm going to just simply talk about three things. We have identified in our office and in our community that lifestyles are a major cause of health care costs. And we've come up with four programs that are very simple. One is a walking fitness from the Crew Cooper Institute, weight control, non-smoking, and educational involving wellness and nutrition. If you have those pamphlets we handed out, if you can look at this page here, the Wellness and Lycare Associates. And the second page is pictured here. And that's where we're kind of pointing and encouraging our employees to go to. This is a BMI, Body Mass Index, and we want people to move to the green area. And we give them $60 a month if they're there or if they're in a program that gets them there. The second group, it's the third page in, is a fitness assessment, and that is from the Cooper Institute, and we have people walk around the track four times, that's a mile, according to these brackets here. If they can do it within that, they qualify for the dividend. If they don't, then they're in a STEPS program, a YMCA STEPS program, to get them there. The non-smoking and the educational passive, either you smoke or you don't smoke, we encourage them to not smoke, and we've had pretty good results in moving people away from smoking. The back page of that, the middle part of that, are the results in our office. It's this green picture. And what we'll see is three groups of people. The first group are the people that qualify, and that's about 45% of our employees, and they get the dividend. The second group is the people that are working on programs, and they get the dividend. That's about 35%. And then there's about 20% that voluntarily do not want to participate. And we're working that with that group to try to get it down to 10%. And what we're here for in House Bill 4074 is to create a partnership between the political leadership, the local employers, the insurance companies, to help our employees develop their own wellness programs. And we've kind of worked that out over the last year. And because it's their program, they're doing it. And we'll go into the we've given you the results and the movement of people from the non-participating group to the participating, and the movement of the participating people to the total qualifiers. This bill will help us motivate people more in that direction.
Co-chairs Representative Greenlick and Representative Thompson, and Vice Co-Chair Representative Kinnemer and Hoyle, and representatives. My name is Nadine Wood, and I'm a resident of Albany, Oregon, and I'm here to talk in support of House Bill 4074. Nearly 3 years ago, I addressed the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs in support of Senate Bill 679 that unanimously passed in the 2009 legislative session, and it was signed into law in June of 2009. The passage of Senate Bill 679 opened the door for collaboration between employers and insurance companies and employees to develop workplace disease prevention programs that carry a financial incentive to those who choose to participate. Since the passage of that bill, I have had the unique experience to work with Dr. Lees and his employees to develop a employee wellness program. We looked at a framework for that program and then handed it over to a wellness committee, and they have this very simple, very functional, very unique to their office wellness program that I have seen amazing results. I was hired a few months ago as the employee wellness coordinator, so I look at the data that comes in monthly and consult with the employees to make sure that they're where they would like to be or where they could be in order to earn this dividend. And it's been some of the results have been pretty amazing. I've witnessed some medical changes in terms of blood screenings. Obviously, they started earlier than the few months that I've been there, but when they've looked back at their records, smoking cessation, weight loss,
And basically, a real sense in office of camaraderie, and we're in this together, and how can we address this issue? It's been, for me, very rewarding. I think it's unfortunate that there aren't more opportunities for this kind of a program to get started. Part of it is a financial difficulty. Because what I've seen is just this groundwork of, let's work together and change some of our habits, and definitely seeing a healthier population. So I would ask you to take this House bill into very serious consideration and look at it as a way to, one other way to prevent the rising health care costs by allowing people to be more responsible and employers being able to give some incentives to their employees. Thank you for your time.
Co-chairs Representative Greenlake, Representative Thompson, and committee members. I'm Cynthia Brooks. I'm general manager at iCare Associates, Albany, Corvallis, and Lebanon, Oregon. You've heard testimony today regarding the benefits of health and wellness plan, and now I'd like to tell you about Joe. Joe began smoking at the age of 6. And learned to inhale at the age of 7. He continued to smoke until he was 32, stopped for 6 years, and then began again. Joe, who is now 54, works for our organization, and we're proud to say that after implementation of our health and wellness dividend plan, he has quit smoking. I share this story with you, not because Joe is unique, but rather because he's not unique. Our organization includes single mothers, single fathers, employers who are very educated, and those with GEDs. We have employees who were previously on the Oregon Health Plan, those who have received food stamps. There are those who rent and those who own more than one home. In general, our organization represents a cross-section of Oregon residents. We know from the results we've seen from our group that health and dividend plans work for employees from very diverse walks of life, and that people respond better to a carrot than they do to a stick. Empowering people to make life changes is not dependent on where a person is or has been, but rather where they want to go. Our employees recognize they are part of an exciting new healthcare movement. Making this dividend tax exempt will send a powerful message of support to participants of health and wellness plans. It will create a collegiate atmosphere between employers, employees, insurance companies, and most importantly, Representative Andrews and Senator Frank Morse. I encourage your support of House Bill 4074. Isn't it right to support the very people who are making the biggest difference in the long-term savings of health care dollars?
It's my understanding that this bill allows insurance companies to pay dividends but does not require it. Is that true?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And employers, too.
And employers, yes, mm-hmm. Right. Okay. I was looking at it from a mandate standpoint. Mm-hmm. And secondly, without violating HIPAA, can any of you tell me whether or not Representative Olson qualifies for a dividend, or is he a couch potato?
Yeah. Under the BMI here.
Yeah. I was looking at him trying to run my finger down the BMI chart. Yeah. I can't make it work. Okay, enough of that.
Can I ask a question?
You certainly can.
Why can't an employer do this now? In fact, you are doing it, right?
We are doing it.
So why?
What we're asking for, Representative Lee, is tax-exempt status for the dividend that's being paid to the employees who participate in this program. Mm.
That's why it's going to revenue. Okay, mm-hmm. I got it. That explains why it's going to revenue from here. Thank you.
Intriguing idea. If we put skin in the game, we might get results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you can do it now. It's just that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we've done.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Very briefly, like I always am, I worked for an employer that had this program, and they had an incentive for quitting smoking, and there were quite a few of us who quit smoking. They paid for the program, paid for an incentive afterwards, and that was easily 10, 15, 20 years ago, so I commend you for bringing this to our attention, especially in this day and age when we're trying to make a healthier Oregon. So, thank you.
Is there anyone else for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. And next we will call up John Powell.
You should change the description of this if what it's about is tax exemption.
We're giving you no break today.
No break. Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regis Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon in support of House Bill 4074, and urge you to pass it on to the Revenue Committee as soon as possible. We've been working on this concept with Dr. Lees, who happened to have been a constituent of mine, and you can tell by his age and mine that was a while ago. But he has been concerned about the broader health of his community all of those years, and this is not new to him. And in meeting with him and staff and the people who have counseled him on this program, as you've witnessed today, he still has that fire in the belly to improve the health of his community. And he knows that true health reform is going to happen one person at a time. Mm-hmm. And so we urge support of this bill and be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, please.
So, John, as I read this, it looks like it obviously would not apply to CCOs.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson represent Conger. That's correct. I don't think it would.
No more questions, but just a comment. I think that's a glaring hole in our healthcare transformation. I've said it before. I'll continue saying it. But I have to agree with the good doctor that healthcare, ultimately, good outcomes, has got to start with the patient and their buy-in to the whole process. And if they're not bought in and it can't be brought in, then how ultimately are we going to achieve what we're all trying to achieve here? So I'll support the bill, but I wish it included CCOs.
Well, can I comment on that, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
The current CCO transformation relates to Medicaid patients only, so there's some federal regulations around that. But the notion is this kind of model could fit easily into a CCO as they expand their population from Medicaid. But I think we are restricted in the Medicaid population.
I understand. I just think it's a shame. I think it's a real problem with what we're passing in the context of CCOs.
Maybe we want to speak to the governor about that relative to his waivers he's going to be asking for from the feds.
I have brought it up with Mike Bonetto and Bruce Goldberg. I don't know how far it's gotten, but I would love to have more people joining with me in asking for that.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, please.
Is there anything in the CCO structure that would prohibit them from doing this?
No.
Anything else? Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4074. And we're going to carry the work session on this over to Wednesday. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4128. Representative Hoyle.
And Representative Hoyle's going down to the table. Co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 4128 requires that health benefit plans to cover medically necessary dental or orthodontic services for treatment of craniofacial anomalies. There, I have a no revenue impact, but there are also, pardon me, there's a dash one amendment. I've received the revenue impact on the amendment, but not the fiscal.
For the record, Val Hoyle, still representing House District 14, West Virginia, Junction City. I would like to request that John Powell come up with me for this testimony. Is that all right?
You have unlimited authority. You can of course request.
I don't remember you said.
Can
that.
We vote on that, Mr. Chair?
Is that yeah, he's been is he being subpoenaed time. Or is this a friendly request?
This is a friendly request.
Okay, good.
So this bill requires that individual health insurance policy covering hospital, surgical, and dental services to cover medically necessary procedures relating to craniofacial anomalies identifiable at birth, that they also cover the orthodontia that's needed. So I'm not going to go into all the details because we've got some experts here that can tell you more about cleft lip, palate. But the way that it stands now under the law, health insurance companies cover the surgeries for cleft lip and palate, but not the orthodontia, because there was really an issue about, well, if you have dental insurance, would dental insurance cover orthodontia? If they did cover orthodontia, would it be the kind of orthodontist that could actually do this very specialized work? And at the end of the day, if a child gets the orthodontia, they don't have to have as many surgeries. So it costs less money. It's better for the child. And so we worked with the Dental Association and with Tom Holt and John Powell in the insurance industry. And I have to say, they have been fantastic. And everybody just said this in the last session, said, let's do something in February where we can talk about this, come together, figure out what works for everyone. And they've just been phenomenal in saying, how do we make this work? So this is a consensus bill. It's really great. And I think it should pass.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We heartily concur with what Representative Hoyle has presented to you today. Providing this coverage at an early stage in life is essential for the well-being of these citizens of ours. And the Dash 1 amendments really are ours and the work of Tom Holt at Regents, and he sends his apologies for not being able to be here today. So with the Dash 1 amendments, we're in full support of the bill and hope that you'll take action soon.
Thank you. And I think there's some other people here to testify on the bill.
Yes, we do.
Far more interesting people than us.
Thank you.
I'm going to next call Dr. Garfinkel, who I understand has a time constraint, and Dean Hale and Stacy Michelson. If you'd like to begin, please do so. Identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, and members of the House Healthcare Committee. My name is Judah Garfinkel. I'm representing the Oregon Dental Association as an orthodontist in support of House Bill 4128, but also as Director of Craniofacial Orthodontics at OHSU, as a native Oregonian, and as a father of two small children. It's my honor, privilege, and responsibility to address you today to voice my support of HB 4128 that would call for medical insurance companies operating in Oregon that offer individual and group plans to stand behind their subscriber members that are born with clefts of the lip and palate and other craniofacial anomalies by covering medically necessary dental procedures. During my brief testimony, we will examine the impact of one's life resulting from a birth defect to the face, bridge the divide between medical and dental treatment when it comes to cleft and craniofacial conditions, and discuss what medically necessary means. If a birth defect affects an individual's leg, and correcting it is possible, it is not considered a cosmetic repair. Rather, the restoration of function is considered necessary and not questioned to allow the individual to be able to walk, be active, and carry out the actions that require two working legs. There is no debate or issue when it comes time for an insurance company to cover the indicated procedures, and it should be no different when we think about repairing a birth defect that affects the face. The repair should be covered by the insurance company to allow the organ, or the face, to carry out its intended purpose. Well, what's the purpose of our faces? Coordination of breathing, eating, swallowing, hearing, smelling, and both verbal and nonverbal communication. We all recognize and accept that these functions are an indispensable part of what makes us human and able to be productive members of this society. And it follows that repair of this defect to these structures is not cosmetic, rather it is functional like restoring one's leg. The mental hurdle that needs to be cleared is in the management of the teeth, which happen to be intimately connected to the face. Teeth are necessary for many basic functions we take for granted: chewing, nonverbal communication, and speech. in other craniofacial disorders that this bill would cover, such as Treacher-Collins syndrome, where the lower jaw or mandible and the cheeks or zygomas are very small, and craniofacial microsomia, where half of the face is smaller than the other side. The jaw bones can be severely affected, greatly impacting the basic functions of the face and mouth, and it is impossible to restore function without addressing the teeth. The body and medicine just do not work that way. Let's look at a specific treatment step for cleft lip and palate to highlight the intimate connection between medical and dental treatment. Each tooth in your mouth has a root. Each root is supported by a bone. The bone that supports the teeth is affected by clefts of the lip and palate. And insurance companies recognize this deformity and cover the medical costs associated with fixing this tooth-supporting bone. The issue here is that proper management of this bone requires coordinated dental treatment. I have personally seen dozens of these surgeries fail and teeth lost that otherwise could have been saved, secondary to not managing the teeth prior to and after the surgery. This leads to senseless need to repeat surgeries, increasing the burden or cost of health care, putting the patient at risk by having to repeat the surgery, and subjecting each child to treatment below the standard of care. This specific example is a surgery called an alveolar bone graft. Bone cannot form on teeth, so teeth need to be orthodontically moved away from the cleft site or extracted prior to the surgery, or else the graft in the area will fail. And every bone graft surgery that I have seen that was performed with a tooth in the wrong place has failed, and there is just no reason for it. Further, clefting often results in an underbite, which can frequently be corrected orthodontically. Otherwise, jaw surgery may be indicated. Either way, proper treatment requires appropriate management of the dentition. It would seem to me that if medical doctors could provide the indicated dental procedures we are talking about, then we would probably not be sitting here today discussing this issue. But since they cannot, the dental community has stepped up, and the insurance companies have drawn an artificial and arbitrary line between what they deem medically necessary, basing it on professional degree or billing codes, instead of the scientific literature. In my mind, it is medically necessary if the reason the intervention is indicated is secondary to the patient's congenital anomaly. As a precedent, 16 states currently have similar legislation on the books, and many others are in the process of doing so. There are also groups working for this issue on the federal level. In conclusion, I hope that I have been able to illustrate the profound impact a craniofacial condition can have to basic functions and quality of life, and that the standard of care requires that some medically necessary dental procedures should be covered by health insurance companies operating in Oregon. For these reasons, I hope you will join me in supporting House Bill 4128 and improve the quality of care for the children of Oregon affected by cleft and craniofacial conditions. Thank you for this opportunity to address you.
Thank you. Next.
Co-chairs Thompson and Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacey Michelson, policy associate with Children First for Oregon. Children First has long been an advocate for children's health in our state, and I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 4128, as we see the dental and orthodontic treatment for oral facial clefts as an important step forward for kids. Oral facial clefts are one of the most common craniofacial birth defects, with a total of 68 cases in Oregon in 2007 alone. And as you've heard from, you know, other experts already today, and we'll continue to hear from others who can give you far more of a medical background than I can, cleft palates really negatively affect a number of areas for children, ranging from growth and teeth development, as well as breathing and speech, but also impact learning and language ability and cognitive and psychomotor skills. With proper treatment, these issues can really successfully be addressed. But this treatment is often intensive and, as you've heard, requires a coordination of services. And as the example was previously given, when teeth aren't extracted prior to surgery, the surgery often fails and requires multiple procedures following that. Conversely, when surgeons and orthodontists are able to work together, often these procedures can be conducted under one anesthesia, ultimately, you know, saving costs, as well as pain and time for the child and their family. But as we've heard, not all insurance providers cover this full spectrum of treatments that are necessary to address cleft palates. And unfortunately, when a family can't afford the full cost of some of these treatments, they may delay part or all of the treatment that's necessary. And delaying the treatment ultimately impacts a child's ability to overcome the obstacles that involve the cleft palate. Children First perspective, and I think you would agree, is that no child should, you know, face a difficult life simply because their family can't access the dental care required to treat a birth defect. And for that reason, I would urge you all to support House Bill 4128 and pass with a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick and Representative Hoyle. Thank you for being here. I'm not an expert. I'm a parent of a child who's cleft affected, and this touches me closely. Whatever happens,
your name, please.
My name is Dean Hale. I come from Eugene. Whatever happens in the legislation, I'm not affected. My children are grown, and the rule will not affect us. But I'd like you to hear a little bit. On the way to Portland, there's a billboard with a photo of a cleft-affected child, and they ask for donations to help close lips. This transforms lives, but it's only a small fraction of the restoration work needed. Kids with clefts often require surgeries and special dental and orthodontic services. Many of the restorative services cannot be done without before and after dental and orthodontic services. Insurance companies that deny dental and orthodontic services do harm to cleft-affected children. This often creates a dead end for treatment. This marginalizes children. With unrestored function, they cannot eat or speak correctly, and many face stigma socially and in the workplace. So the simple denial of dental and orthodontic services sets up a person for downward spiral. The dental and orthodontic bills that I have resemble car payments, luxury car payments, for the last 10 years. It is a huge drain. But as a parent, I will sacrifice what's necessary for my child. The family car got so old that we risked breakdowns on the 100 trips we took to Portland. And the suit I'm wearing today is one I inherited from my father in the 1990s. The denial of orthodontic services for children with craniofacial disorders limits treatment and surgical options. Those who don't get treatment are marginalized and will have more difficulty attaining scholastic and career success. This negatively affects Oregon's workforce. Last year, my daughter's treatments were done. She's 19 now. We had discovered that some regression just this last month, one of her front teeth are hitting each other. This affects speech, chewing, and digestion. There are two options. The first is surgical. The second is orthodontic. Orthodontic is cheaper, but not covered by insurance. But surgery is not ideal, as scar tissue from the previous surgery compromises the chance for success. And with surgery, every surgery, there's always a risk for mortality. So insurance language can drive bad practice. Another surgery is not in my daughter's best interest. So a short-sighted policy, ostensibly to save money, will actually cost more money but put patients at risk. This is dysfunctional. These are the facts. While I can be a good advocate for my child, most parents get overcome and worn out by the system and give up. I've seen that too often when meeting parents of other cleft-affected kids. Oh, and I want to tell you about my daughter. You should have seen the glee that she had when the surgeries were complete and she could actually bite an apple. As they say, that was priceless. She's a thriving college freshman, thanks to some scholarships. She loves theater and is considering a career in diplomacy and human resources. Her resilience will ensure her success in any career she chooses. Whatever happens to H.R. 4128 will be too late to benefit our family, so I have no self-interest in this. But this bill will be a godsend for many Oregon families. It is now time to pass this legislation. And as Dr. Garfinkel has said, it is becoming a standard mandate in many states in the U.S. It's time for Oregon, too. Thank you for the opportunity to speak for me to speak to you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for this panel?
No, just thank you very much for coming.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that. Thank you very much for coming down and speaking on behalf of families who aren't here today.
Can I say something?
You're welcome.
And can I...
Yeah, I guess.
Oh, yes.
I just want to add that she, you know, is in the place she is because of her resilience, but also she's fortunate to have you to keep fighting for her and for everyone else affected. Thank you.
Parents' duty.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add thank you for sharing your priceless moment. It touches us all, I think. Congratulations.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 4128. I understand we're not ready to move the bill today because of one of the glitches that I've been talking about earlier, but we do have an amendment that we can deal with. So I'm going to open a work session on the dash one amendments to House Bill 4128.
I move that we I move that we adopt the dash one amendments for our House Bill 4128. Dated on the February 2nd, 2012.
Representative Hoyle has moved that we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2148, dated 4128. It's my dyslexia again. Dated 2/2/12. So any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, just to be on the safe side, I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest. My son-in-law is a hotshot Indo-Donist.
You just wanted to fly.
Well, okay, so it's bragging rights.
It's not a declaration of conflict. Real quick point of clarification. These types, what we're doing here is already covered under the Oregon Health Plan. This bill's just dealing with commercial insurance.
This bill just deals with regulated commercial insurance.
Yeah. Yes.
This stuff is probably covered now under the health plan. So.
Yeah, actually, this gives direction and clarification to the Oregon Health Plan. But children under the Oregon Health Plan have dental and it's medical, so it's different. But this also only applies to those health insurance companies that would cover the surgical part, so that would cover the medical corrections that would initially take place. And so, yes.
Dr. Shercliffe, I'm going to depart from the usual course of events and ask you to clarify your head motions very quickly, please. So we get it right. Please identify yourself.
Mike Shercliffe, Advantage Dental. Orthodontics is already covered under the Oregon Health Plan for cleft palate patients. Recipients.
Yeah. Okay. So this applies to whom?
This applies to the commercial.
Well, I just wanted it on the record.
No, this applies to the regulated insurance, which are individual and groups under 100. Which are the only ones that we regulate under.
Paul, would you like to departing from the format once again?
You might as well know what we're doing.
Co-Chair Thompson.
We're not
Co-Chair Greenlick, John Powell for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. This would apply to any policy written and delivered of any size by a commercial insurer licensed under the statute that's referenced, 735, 730. So it would include large group as well, Representative.
Well, what makes this different from other mandates that we usually?
Co-Chairs Greenlick and Thompson. Co-Chair Greenlick, it really isn't different. And as you point out, I think, in your statement, self-insured policies, self-insureds are not subject to state mandates. And you pointed that out in your committee before, that at times people think a problem has been totally alleviated when, in fact, it isn't, because under federal law, the legislature cannot affect employee benefits under HIPAA.
But it also covers large groups in this case.
It would.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I apologize for that disruption, but I have a policy of always trying to get the facts straight before we screw it up, right?
Silly guy.
And you're all with me, right?
Yes, silly guy.
No, thank you. I was.
We helped push you down the road.
Usually these things happen. We read about it in the Oregonian tomorrow that we did something that wasn't right, so if we can try to get it right, that helps.
We do have a motion on the table.
Yes, we have a motion on the table for the dash one amendments. Is there any further discussion?
is there any resistance, reluctance, or opposition? I'm going to declare the dash one amendments attached to the bill.
Okay.
And we will close the work session on 41-28. Okay. Problem with fours today. Okay. Noticing that we didn't lose very many people from the room, which I anticipated that could happen. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 4122, which we started earlier as the infamous PBM bill. And we're going to, we've got about 15, maybe 20 minutes tops. So I'm going to ask that you keep be very, very brief in your comments. We are not going to move this bill today. At present, and we've got a couple of things we need to clarify, but it is my intention, meeting with my co-chair later, that we will move this bill to a work group, formal work group, and continue working on it until the 2013 session. I want to get a good start on this, clarify some things, and give us a launching point to do that. So with that, I'm going to call our out-of-town visitors, Peter Hardy, David Dietrichs, Eric Douglas, and I'll throw in Jim Gardner, but he's not from out of town.
Well, some of us wish he were.
Again, if you identify yourself when you begin to speak and keep it as short as you can, there's going to be plenty of opportunity to dig into this thing beyond today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Dave Dietrichs, and I work for Express Scripts. We're a pharmacy benefits manager based out of St. Louis, Missouri. We administer the prescription drug benefits for 50 million Americans across the United States. We are contracted by Fortune 500 companies, labor unions, health insurers, and government entities to administer the prescription drug benefit portion of their health insurance. Our largest contract is with the United States Department of Defense. We provide the prescription drug benefit for all of our current active and retired U.S. military personnel and their families around the world. That's about 13 million people. We're particularly proud of that contract. We make prescription drugs safer and more affordable for our clients by administering this benefit. We do things like utilize generics, negotiating discounts from brand name manufacturers, utilizing mail order pharmacy services, setting up contracts of retail pharmacy networks, and performing drug utilization reviews to prevent adverse drug interactions. We do oppose House Bill 4122 for two main reasons, which my colleagues and I will probably expand upon in the next few minutes. Number one, shifting the regulatory authority over our industry to the Board of Pharmacy, we believe creates a conflict of interest. And number two, the massive disclosure requirements that could cripple parts of our industry. Overall, we believe this bill harms competition and consumers. And in the interest of brevity, Mr. Chair, I'm going to skip most of my testimony and go right to some points that were made by the Federal Trade Commission last year regarding a very substantially similar bill that was introduced in Mississippi that did require two things. Number one, that PBMs register for licensure with the Board of Pharmacy, and number two, it also contained disclosure requirements. I'm just going to read you a few things that the Federal Trade Commission, in their unanimous decision to oppose this legislation, wrote to the Mississippi legislature. They said this bill will increase pharmaceutical prices and reduce competition. First, allowing the Board of Pharmacy to regulate PBMs will likely undermine the PBM's ability to negotiate lower prices for prescription drugs, which in turn will raise those prices for both insurers and consumers covered by insurance. Second, the bill appears to allow the Pharmacy Board to obtain from PBMs financial and any other business information it desires, and then to provide that information to third parties. If pharmaceutical manufacturers, pharmacists, and pharmacies gain access to whatever information the Pharmacy Board requires PBMs to produce, they could have access to competitively sensitive information, potentially facilitate collusion, and increase prescription drug prices for health plans, plan and sponsors, and consumers. Shifting regulatory authority and power to the Pharmacy Board, which in the case of Oregon consists of five-member pharmacists, It says pharmacists who negotiate retail prescription drug prices with PBMs and compete against PBM mail-owned order pharmacies would create a conflict of interest, because in a marketplace where you have two competing entities and then giving one regulatory authority over the other could cause collusion. Because pharmacies and pharmacists and PBMs have a competitive and at times adversarial relationship, the FTC is concerned that giving the pharmacy board regulatory authority over PBMs may create tensions and conflicts of interest for the pharmacy board. Indeed, antitrust laws recognize there is a real danger that regulatory boards composed of market participants may pursue their own interests than those of the state. And then regarding disclosure, it's pretty clear that the FTC and all of their rulings over the last decade, I actually have printed up six other rulings on disclosure bills that they have commented on from New York, Virginia, California, North Carolina, all over the last few years, and I highlighted and tabbed all of these, and they've come to the unanimous conclusion, as well as the Department of Justice, that requiring us to disclose confidential trade and secret information, particularly to entities that we compete with, can foster collusion, it'll lead to higher prescription drug prices, and they equate it to customers having unlimited access to some of our sensitive information that is found nowhere else in the marketplace today. And with that, I'll be happy to end my remarks and pass it along to my colleagues.
You certainly
very
can.
Very briefly. So sure. I take it you'd have no problem if you were to be regulated under, say, the Division of Business and Consumer Affairs, DCBS, whatever it is.
Mr. Chairman, that is factually, actually, I'm not really sure what the Department of Insurance is in Oregon, or Department of Commerce, but in most states, that's who we are usually licensed with or regulated with.
So that would be okay. I take it.
We would have to see what
they'll have the exposure of information and all that stuff.
Yeah, because they'd be careful. Yeah. You're on record here.
Right. Getting it out of the
please eat this apple.
Yeah. Take away one of your problems.
Thank you for your time.
Please.
Committee co-chairs.
Also invite any of you who have written documentation, testimony, anything you want to submit, please do so to the committee, and we'll get it distributed, and it will be part of the work group. So. Please continue.
Thank you. Committee co-chairs Thompson and Greenlick, co-vice chairs Hoyle and Kinnemer. My name is Eric Douglas. I am Director of Government Affairs for CBS Caremark. Along with my colleague, CBS Caremark is also here today in opposition of House Bill 4122. In the interest of being brief, you have or will soon have my written testimony for the record. I wanted to touch on a couple of points briefly. As my colleague here just mentioned, licensure by the Board of Pharmacy would certainly be a problem for CVS Caremark. Boards of pharmacy regulate the practice of pharmacy and pharmacist licensure. The boards are generally charged with protecting the health of consumers in the state that they are regulating with respect to the practice of pharmacy itself. The Board of Pharmacy is not a fiscal or benefits agency, and the members of the board generally do not have expertise in those matters. And lastly, Board of Pharmacy members, as my colleague touched on, have a clear conflict of interest because they have contractual relationships with PBMs to provide services as a part of pharmacy networks and are also competitors of PBM mail order pharmacies. The second thing I'd like to mention is access. I know that's been brought up a number of times this afternoon. Using 2011 data, CVS Caremark has 728 Oregon pharmacies in our network. 515 of those are chain pharmacies, that's 70.74%, and 213 of those are independent pharmacies. That's 29.26%. Using the most recent available data I could get from one of the proponents of the bill, the National Association of Chain Drug Stores, the numbers they show were from 2010, so 1 year earlier, 590 total pharmacies in Oregon, 464 chain, and 126 independents, or about 27%. These numbers demonstrate the number of pharmacies overall in Oregon continue to grow, not shrink. Our pharmacy network of independents CVS Caremark specifically, is growing relative to chains, and most chain and independent pharmacies in Oregon participate within the CVS Caremark network. And with that, I'll pass the testimony over to my colleague.
Thank you. Gutierrez Thompson and Greenlink members of the committee. My name is Peter Hardy, and I'm with Medco Health Solutions, Inc., also a PBM. We're based in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey. We also oppose this bill. Understanding that there will be work group meetings, and I'd offer to participate or to have Medco participate to the extent possible within that work group. We'd love to have that opportunity. I have three main points that I want to get across that we can explore further in that work group based upon some of the testimony we've heard so far. First, issues of what drugs are on the formulary. What's the copay that's charged for that drug? Do you go to mail service or retail to get it? Those are not decisions that we as PBMs make. Those are decisions that the payers, be it the state of Oregon, be it Regents, be it United Health Group, be it an employer, those are decisions that they make in terms of the benefit that they are offering to their members and to their employees. We administer the benefit that they've decided to offer, so when there's a question about whether the drug is covered or not, it's not a decision that we've made. And I just wanted to put that out there. Those decisions belong to the fiduciary, which is the plan sponsor itself. Transparency. As an industry, we're not opposed to transparency. What we're, in fact, we actually support a market-based transparency where we're more than happy to contract with our clients and provide them with whatever information, whether it's financial or otherwise, that they want through a competitive RFP process. What we're opposed to is state-mandated transparency requirements, and the FTC in some of the letters that Mr. Dietrich referred to before has made the observation that the market will provide the most optimal level of transparency, not state regulation of that issue, and that if you pass legislation along those lines, it would apply transparency industries transparency standards to only one industry and not to anybody else. Nobody else is held to those sorts of mandated transparency requirements. The third point that I would like to make, just back to the second point, it's interesting to note that despite the nature of this bill, I don't think that you'll see any health plans in the state here supporting the bill asking for statutory transparency. I think that you'll find that they believe that the market has addressed those issues as we do. The third and final point that I'd like to make is we're really not trying to put anybody out of business. I heard the testimony from Ms. Murray earlier previously, and I understand that there are plenty of independent pharmacies that are having trouble staying in business. It's actually contrary to what you may think. It's in our best interest to keep those stores in business to the extent that we possibly can. At Medco in 2010, we managed, the last year for which we have numbers available, we managed about 740 million prescriptions. 110 million of those went through our mail service pharmacies. 630 million went through retail. So it's almost a 6-to-1 ratio of what goes through retail as opposed to what goes through mail service. And we need independents because we're often in the rural areas, they're in the places where the chains are not, and we do our best to try to keep those folks in business through various things that we have that we can explore later on. So about 85% of the prescriptions nationally are filled through retail pharmacies. So we really are, as an industry, trying to keep the independents and the pharmacy community alive and vibrant. So with that, I'll close my remarks and defer to the other gentlemen on the panel.
Well, one quick question while he's doing that. Why is it that we keep getting the issues that PBMs are reimbursing pharmacies at less than their purchase price? That's been going on for years, and it seems to impact the greatest smaller rural pharmacies, but how is that a business model that works for you if you want to keep the pharmacies alive?
Okay, Mr. Co-Chair Thompson, I know at Medco and different companies.
No, I wouldn't expect you to know all of them.
I know that we do have a committee that reviews when that issue gets raised with us, and I'll talk to Ms. Murray and I'll give her my card, frankly, and so that I can get her in touch with somebody at Medco to talk about this specifically. I know that we do have a group that looks at reimbursement issues, you know, when it's presented to them, and they, you know, review what information they have available and make a decision about whether there ought to be an adjustment to the reimbursement rate based upon that information that's available. Remember that we're working with 65,000 pharmacies on a nationwide basis, and so, you know, when these local issues based upon, you know, prices for pharmacies here come to our attention, you know, we appreciate that input and we'll at least, you know, talk about it. Can't guarantee that we'll give them the reimbursement rate that they're looking for, but we need to take it into consideration.
I only bring it up because it's come up for years. We passed a bill a couple of sessions ago that tried to address it, but not perfectly. But I'm very familiar with that small rural pharmacy, family-owned business model. They're stuck between the price they have to pay their distributor and the price they're reimbursed by the PBM and the size of their market, which they can't expand. They have 100% of it. So it's a real squeeze. I know for a fact here in Oregon, we are consistently losing small independently owned pharmacies in rural areas where we need them desperately because of what else we're doing in healthcare transformation. So we have to answer that basic question moving forward and find a remedy to keep these people alive in the rural and probably in the cities too. But the rural, it's really a crunch because they're the only show in town for sometimes 100 miles, often 100 miles. So it's a big deal. Thank you. You're on.
Thank you, sir. Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. My name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I'll keep my statement very brief. You do have my written testimony. I simply wanted to underscore the wisdom of Co-Chair Thompson's statement that the best course of action is to send this to a work group in the run-up to 2013. This is a very complex piece of legislation. I'll highlight very quickly three complexities that emerge from the most recent iteration, the -2 amendments, the decision to exclude governmental PBMs. Perhaps that's a good decision, a good rationale, but that needs some articulation as to why. Second, the exclusion, proposed exclusion of health insurers, but not TPAs. So that's, to the extent there's not an ERISA issue, that's something that bears some scrutiny. And finally, and most troublesome, is the inclusion of entities which conduct programs related to disease management, patient compliance, or therapeutic intervention, but which do not conduct any of the other traditional PBM-like activities seems somewhat problematic. That's all I have.
Are there any questions for this panel?
Thank you guys for coming.
Yes, please.
I hope you get to go fishing or something.
Yell out if I don't spot you right away.
I will. Yeah. Jim, I guess you don't want to answer this question, but you may not know the answer. I'm just curious. All three of the PBMs represented here today have your own mail order prescription filling business. And do you have to, I mean, are your pharmacists licensed or regulated by the state of Oregon?
I'll go first, Mr. Chairman.
Representative. Oh, I'll have to answer it. I'm basically just wondering, in fact, who is it who regulates you?
Yeah, our pharmacists that work at our non-resident mail order facilities, the ones that are out of state that ship the prescription drugs in, those pharmacists are usually licensed or regulated through the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, as well as, depending on the state regulation, the pharmacist in charge of that facility sometimes, I'm not sure what the case is in Oregon, has to be a licensed pharmacist in that state, you know, and keep up with the continuing education credits and whatnot. I did actually, in preparation for this testimony, I started pulling. We have upwards of 20 licenses in this state, and whether it's TPA for our specialty pharmacies or even our controlled substances, wholesalers, and yes, our out-of-state mail order pharmacies.
What's a TPA?
Third-party administrator.
Just a comment, not necessarily a question, because I know this is going to go to a work group, and I don't want to belabor this all day. Do we have another panel coming up?
Yes,
I assume we have more.
Okay. Yeah, we'll be carrying this over, though.
Understood.
Well,
I have many other questions, but it's probably best left to a work group. But just one comment. You made the statement that PBMs save money, and I think there might be two ways to interpret that. One is they save money for the insurers, and the other is they save money for the healthcare system as a whole by realizing efficiencies and things like that. I think it'd be very useful for me as a policymaker, if I have to vote on this bill, to actually see some data to back up that statement, and from the perspective of the healthcare system, not necessarily just savings that might administrative savings that might be realized by the insurers.
Thanks.
The question I have deals with when you've got mail order prescriptions, how quickly you can get it to, because do you realize in Oregon we don't have daily delivery service in some areas of our state? And so the question is do you make specific accommodations, whether it's Federal Express or UPS or something like this, as opposed to sometimes U.S. mail, because sometimes people can't get the prescriptions because of the scarcity of mail service, I guess?
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and Representative Doherty, yes, we can do that. We actually, at all of our mail order facilities, we take the patient's consideration, needs into consideration. In fact, to give you a great example, we have a specialty pharmacy facility. It's actually located at the Indianapolis airport, and we keep contractually planes on ready standby with both Federal Express and UPS in the case of whether we need to get medications to our patients in a very timely manner. For example, hemophilia medications are very sensitive, very rare, very expensive, and they need to be shipped within a certain time frame and refrigerated at a certain temperature, and so yes, we do take all of those factors into consideration.
I take that back, because UPS and those others also are not, we're lucky in the metro area, we have it 2-3 times a day, but mm-hmm. The rural areas, there really is a consideration for that.
Okay, anything else? Well, I apologize to our friends from OSPA. But we are out of time, so I'm going to have to carry this hearing over to Wednesday. But I guarantee all of you, this is not the last we've heard about the PBM issue. So the clock starts today. Sometime during the first 6 months of 2013, we will have a resolution that's going to make everyone happy.
Yay.
That's the goal.
Well, that's the goal. I thought that was the promise.
No, I'm short of promises. So, and we will carry this hearing over until Wednesday. So before we adjourn, close the public hearing on House Bill 4128 for today, before we close out the committee.
Hey, guys.
We're carrying over to Wednesday the work session on House Bill 4046, work session on House Bill 4127, work session on House Bill 4074, work session on House Bill 4128. We'll have a public hearing and a possible work session on Wednesday on House Bill 4135 and House Bill 4122. Yep. And I apologize for the fact that this is a 28-day session, and the committee meetings aren't 4 hours long, but that's the way it is. So, well, hopefully next week we'll get it better, but expect a lot of these kinds of things.
And just for the record, we passed out written testimony from the National Association of Chain Drug Stores in support of House Bill 4122 that I handed out to the committee. Thank you.
And again, any of you, especially on the PBM issue, that have written testimony or documentation you would like to submit, please submit that to our committee administrator, and we will start to build the file for the eventual work group. And is there anything else before the committee? The House Healthcare Committee is adjourned.
Good job. You did a good job.
No, actually,